This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Rachel Wright, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 10th of October, these are our main stories. President Biden has accused Donald Trump of being responsible for what he called an onslaught of lies over the US government's response to two huge hurricanes. Israel's defense minister says his country's retaliation against Iran for its missile attack this month will be lethal, precise, and surprising. The UN Human Rights Council has voted to extend its investigation into alleged rights abuses in Sudan, where the civil war has displaced 10 million people. Also in this podcast,
Ratan Tata was born into the famous family. Remember, his great-grandfather had created this company more than 150 years ago.
Ratan Tata, the influential chairman of one of India's biggest conglomerates, Tata Group, has died at the age of 86. As we record this podcast, Hurricane Milton is now only hours away from reaching the west coast of Florida. But ahead of it, high winds and torrential rain have already caused damage and destruction. The hurricane is expected to make landfall south of the city of Tampa. Millions of people along a stretch of the west coast of Florida are under evacuation orders as forecasters are predicting a life-threatening surge of seawater to waterfront communities. Many residents have moved to shelters, but some are choosing to stay in their homes. Steve Harris has chosen to remain in his house with his pregnant girlfriend.
It's easy for someone to say that's not here. You know, I've had plenty of friends and family and people that know me. Get out. But it's easy to say that when you're not here. When you're here, you got to make those decisions and you got to hope that you're going to come back to something. And it just made it really tough. If we had our own financial backing, we would have been gone Monday, Sunday even. That's not the case. I just don't know if I can leave and then not be able to come back for a while. I'm being very thoughtful and maybe a little nervous.
President Biden's calling it the worst storm for 100 years, and it's forced more than 7 million people out of their homes and into shelters or safer areas. He's accused the former president, Donald Trump, of spreading disinformation, which Mr. Biden said was undermining confidence in rescue and recovery efforts.
Former President Trump has led the onslaught of lies. Assertions have been made that property is being confiscated. That's simply not true. They're saying people impacted by these storms will receive $750 in cash and no more. That's simply not true. They're saying the money is needed for this crisis is being diverted to migrants. What a ridiculous thing to say. It's not true.
Our correspondent, Gordon Carrera, is in the city of Tampa and sent this report on Wednesday evening.
We are just a few hours from Milton making landfall here on the Florida coast. And you can tell the wind and the rain has really been intensifying. It's coming in bursts, in surges, and we're getting one right now. And in a few moments, we'll be making for cover and higher ground. About half of this city has now left. And Tampa and the wider region has been a place that has been preparing for the worst.
The impact of Hurricane Milton is starting to be felt now here in Florida. Winds and rain are intensifying as the outer edges reach the coast. But everyone knows the full force has yet to hit. It's already been creating tornadoes, with more expected, making life even harder for those who are trying to flee the hurricane's path. President Biden issued the latest warning of its power.
Winds will be fierce at well over 100 miles per hour, with storm surges reaching up to 15 feet and up to 18 inches of rain. It's looking like the storm of the century.
Tampa today had the feel of a ghost town, a city left to the wildlife. The few people still out were mainly trying to make desperate efforts to protect what they could. Like Fatum, who'd kept her shop open so people could get last-minute supplies before boarding it up. She's written her name on her arm in case something happens to her.
I have my name here just in case I got flooded. Nobody knows where I am.
You're that worried? You've written your name on your arm?
It's better for people to know my identity, you know, just in case.
So
you don't know.
Yeah.
This is the worst one. It's going to come, so... Hopefully everybody's safe.
Yeah.
Hopefully it's not bad, just electric and that's it.
Okay.
Yeah, losing power is not a big deal.
Oh, and
yeah. Losing lives is, that's what matters.
Thank you.
At least half the city has left, and police are focusing on those who've remained in the high-risk areas.
So we've evacuated nearly 200,000 people, but the challenge is there's just a few that are still out there, and our officers are going door to door to try to convince those people to actually evacuate. Some are reluctant, but our goal is to save lives here, and the more people we can get evacuated, the more lives we can save.
Diggers have been cleaning up the debris from Hurricane Helene, which hit 2 weeks ago, to try and reduce the risk of Milton throwing all of this around and causing more damage. But time has now run out, and officials are focusing on preparing for the next stage.
You need to prepare for catastrophic impacts. This is going to be a serious storm, one that could forever change communities that are still recovering from Helene.
Now, with the storm about to make landfall, everyone is waiting and bracing for impact.
Gordon Carrera in Tampa. One of the main concerns about Hurricane Milton is the significant storm surge it's likely to cause. The U.S. National Hurricane Center has warned that some areas could be engulfed by huge balls of water as big as 15 feet or 4.5 meters. Mac McGrath explains.
A storm surge is a significant rise in sea level that occurs when the powerful winds of a hurricane push water ahead of it onto the shore. It's triggered by the low atmospheric pressure found in the centre of a storm like Milton, and it's also influenced by the tides. Experts are warning that a surge of up to 15 feet in low-lying areas could accompany this hurricane, with the water acting like a battering ram, generating waves and threatening lives and homes. Broadcasters in the US used 3D simulations to stress the scale of the threat from the surge to their audiences.
Unfortunately, the water is expected to rise even higher at 6 feet above the height of most people. Vehicles get carried away. Structures start to fail. Just look at this.
Another factor that will play a role in the surge and the storm is climate change. Rising temperatures are pushing up sea levels, making surges more dangerous, while a warmer atmosphere holds much more moisture. All that water is the real threat, says Hannah Cloak, professor of hydrology at the University of Reading.
So the rain really covers a very wide area. So we've got some very heavy rainfalls with this hurricane. And that means we've got flash flooding in those areas that they're a little bit steeper. So all of this water combined from the storm surge, from the rain and those rivers bursting their banks means the whole place will be completely underwater.
Even if the hurricane loses strength as it hits land, this will only impact the speed of the winds. The waters will still surge, likely wreaking havoc many miles inland, as Hurricane Katrina did in 2005.
Matt McGrath. Israel's defense minister has said his country's retaliation against Iran for its missile attack earlier this month will be lethal, precise and surprising. In a video published in the Israeli media, Yoav Gallant added that Tehran wouldn't understand how it happened but would see the results. His fiery words follow a much-anticipated phone conversation earlier on Wednesday between President Biden and the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. From Washington, Rowan Bridge reports.
In a statement following the call, the White House gave few details, saying only it condemned the missile attack by Iran on Israel last week. Last week, President Biden appeared to caution the Israelis against attacking Iran's oil facilities, saying he would think about alternative targets. Israel is reportedly considering such an attack following the Iranian missile strike amid growing tensions in the Middle East. In the official readout, the White House said the president had emphasized the need for diplomatic solutions to the conflict with Lebanon and the return of hostages from Gaza. He also said while Israel had a right to defend itself, there was a need to protect civilians, particularly in the Lebanese capital, Beirut. The relationship between Biden and Netanyahu has appeared strained recently. The Israeli defense minister postponed a meeting with the American defense secretary Lloyd Austin. And in his latest book, the author Bob Woodward reports President Biden described Prime Minister Netanyahu at one point as a bad guy. Asked about the nature of their relationship, the president's press secretary said Mr. Netanyahu and Mr. Biden had an honest and direct approach with each other.
Rowan Bridge in Washington. Well, the United Nations says Israeli military evacuation orders are now covering a quarter of Lebanon. The Lebanese government says as many as 1.2 million people have already been displaced. In the south of the country, people in 100 villages have been told to leave, though many have nowhere to go. The southern city of Tyre has been the target of repeated Israeli bombing in recent days. Our senior international correspondent, Orla Guerin, is there and sent us this report.
Well, we've just had a strike very close to our hotel, right behind us. Incredibly loud, incredibly close. We can hear sirens now, first aid rushing to the scene. And there are some civilians I can see very close to the area of the blast.
The strike hit a high-rise building housing a pro-Iranian TV channel. One person was killed. Lebanon is being pounded like Gaza before it. Israel says it's targeting Hezbollah.
Well, this is just the latest strike that we've seen here over the past 45 minutes or so. We've had explosions and smoke filling the horizon. Israel has been intensifying its bombardment here. We're standing in an area of open ground. There is a very large trench which has been dug, a mass grave. We've been told that people will be buried here temporarily. They'll be exhumed later and taken back to their villages for a proper burial when the situation is safer.
A plywood coffin is nailed shut. It holds the remains of a 70-year-old woman called Layla, killed by an Israeli strike. There's a handful of mourners, among them her grieving son. His pain is shared by many broken families here, and so is his rage. Until our last breath, we won't leave our land, he says. If we die, we will all be buried here.
I will stay on my office, on my home, on my land.
That's Murtada Mana, who runs a crisis unit trying to keep the city of Tyre alive. Getting food and blankets to shelters, getting fuel to hospitals. He's surrounded by a small team, some of whom had to flee their homes.
How much risk is there for you and your staff and your volunteers?
I think it's a critical and very dangerous situation for us because Israel, our enemy, and Israel didn't take care on Gaza. They bombed the babies, the children, the hospitals, the shelters. Already we're afraid from this, and if maybe they take this choice.
For all of Israel's airstrikes and its ground invasion, this is still a familiar sound in southern Lebanon. It's Hezbollah firing rockets across the border, the very thing Israel went to war here to stop.
Orla Guerin in southern Lebanon. The UN Human Rights Council has voted to extend its investigation into alleged human rights abuses in Sudan, where civil war has displaced 10 million people in the past year. The investigation was established last October. It's already reported that the Sudanese army and the rival Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, have carried out widespread abuses. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
Sudan's military-led government opposed extending the UN's investigation for another year. It's furious that the army is being viewed through the same lens as the RSF, which it describes as a rebellious militia. But enough countries voted to let the fact-finding mission carry on trying to document the abuses. The army hasn't, like the RSF, been accused of widespread ethnic killings, but the UN investigators have already said that all sides have carried out airstrikes and shelled neighbourhoods, schools and hospitals with a total disregard for the protection of civilians.
Will Ross. The Indian tycoon and former chairman of the Tata Group, Ratan Tata, has died at the age of 86. The Mumbai-based corporation manages more than 100 companies worldwide, employing more than 600,000 people. Our South Asia correspondent, Samira Hussain, told me more about the man behind the multi-billion dollar conglomerate.
Ratan Tata was born into the famous family. Remember, his great-grandfather had created this company more than 150 years ago. He was born in Mumbai and he was raised by his grandmother. And about his upbringing, he said, you know, he was certainly had a lot of opportunities, but often described as a loner, and he even described himself as being really shy. During his tenure of more than two decades as chairman, he is really credited as turning this Indian company into a global empire and just acquiring so many different companies, and he really put Tata right on the global stage.
And what do we attribute that to, his skill and the fact that he transformed this company into one of the largest companies in India?
He really had his sights set on growing the company. If you look at some of the companies that he'd acquired, I mean, he bought some really quintessentially British brands, things like Tetley Tea. It turned Tata into the largest tea maker in the world. He acquired Jaguar Land Rover. And then, of course, the Anglo-Dutch steelmaker Corus. And remember, at that time when he acquired that steelmaker, a lot of people were crediting him, or the company rather, for really saving the British steel industry at that time. Now look, not all of his decisions were absolute triumphs. There were some misses, and probably the most memorable one would be his most ambitious project, which was building the Tata Nano. That was the world's cheapest car. And people looked at that, it was actually a really miscalculation of the Indian consumer. Within a decade, the cars ceased to be produced anymore.
Tell us a bit about what he was like as a man. Was he philanthropic? What was he like?
He was certainly very well known for his business acumen, but he was also really very well known for his philanthropic work. I mean, he did a lot of work for health and education, particularly during COVID. You saw that there was a lot of money that was poured into India's efforts to combat the pandemic. And most recently, he was working with the elderly. He put a lot of money into different kinds of startups, trying to find ways to get the elderly to connect with one another.
So the Prime Minister, Narendra Modi, has led the tributes. What do we think his legacy will be?
Really, what he did was bring Indian conglomerates onto the global stage. And he is absolutely one of the most recognizable, internationally recognized business leaders. And he's left an indelible mark on the country. But I think he also sort of left this aspirational mark on the country in terms of, you know, showing people that you can run an Indian company, but really turn that company into a global brand. And that is especially when you think about when that was done, you know, in the 90s, just as India started opening itself up to more international investment. It was a real sort of feat for an Indian company.
Samira Hussain. This year's Nobel Prize for Chemistry has been awarded to three scientists for their pioneering work on proteins, often described as the building blocks of life. David Baker designed an entirely new type of protein, while John Jumper and Sir Demis Hassabis developed an artificial intelligence tool to map their structure. It means what was once a long and laborious process can be carried out rapidly by computers, with almost 200 million proteins now modelled. The Nobel jury described this as a monumental achievement, which could be used for designing medicines and vaccines. Professor Heiner Linke, the chair of the Nobel Committee for Chemistry, praised the work of the scientists.
It has long been a dream to learn to predict the three-dimensional structure of proteins from knowing their amino acid sequence. For several decades, this was considered impossible. 4 years ago, Demis Hassabis and John Jumper managed to crack the code. They made it possible to predict the complex structure of essentially any known protein in nature.
Our science correspondent Pallab Ghosh has more details.
Neither Sir Demis nor John Jumper are chemists or biologists by training, but they developed an AI system called AlphaFold 2 that predicted virtually all the 200 million proteins that researchers know about. The shape and structure of proteins is key to understanding biology. They're the cogs in the machinery of all living organisms. But protein formation is incredibly complex. The new system has sparked a technological revolution and has led to new industries creating biological-based products and better medicines. I spoke to Sir Demis and asked him how he felt about receiving one of the biggest prizes in science.
Well, it hasn't really sunk in, to be honest. I mean, it's obviously incredible, amazing honour, like, honour of a lifetime, and it's very surreal, really.
In 2003, David Baker succeeded in designing a completely new protein that didn't exist in nature. His achievement opened the way to sculpting whatever human-created biological building blocks we want.
Pallab Ghosh. Still to come. Do you remember this?
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious! That ball was on the line!
Now tennis players will have to shout it at machine instead of the poor old line judges. Hungary's Prime Minister has faced a series of angry insults during an unusually rowdy session of the European Parliament. Viktor Orbán warned that the continent was suffering from an immigration crisis and repeated his call for a ceasefire in Ukraine. This prompted a series of scathing speeches from MEPs, with one accusing Mr. Orbán of acting as Vladimir Putin's mini-me. Here's our Europe regional editor, Paul Moss.
The proceedings began politely enough. Hungary currently holds the presidency of the European Union Council, and the country's Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, was warmly greeted when he arrived at the European Parliament building.
Good morning.
Nice to see you. How are you?
There was a less warm welcome from the President of the European Commission. Ursula von der Leyen said Viktor Orbán was blaming Ukraine for being invaded. But a Dutch MEP, Gerbrand Jan Gerbrandy, went further. He compared the Hungarian Prime Minister's relationship with Vladimir Putin to that of a character from the Austin Powers movie.
No, more like the infamous mini-me, who looks, talks and acts exactly like Dr. Evil, but just sits on his lap.
Mr. Orbán appeared unruffled. Ignoring film character comparisons, he focused on Ursula von der Leyen's speech, which he suggested was not just wrong, but inappropriate.
There are significant differences between the Commission President and Hungary that I intentionally didn't raise as holder of the presidency. I think it's unfortunate she brings these differences to her work as Commission President. This is not proper, in my view.
Viktor Orbán does have plenty of allies in the European Parliament these days. Indeed, today's ill-tempered gathering laid bare once again the bitter divisions which now cut through the European Union, and indeed through Europe itself, over Ukraine, over immigration, and much else besides.
Paul Moss. Conservative members of Parliament in Britain have voted to eliminate the former Home Secretary James Cleverly from the party's leadership contest. Mr. Cleverly, a centrist, was the clear favourite to win after voting on Tuesday, but he received the least votes in the latest ballot, leaving two contenders from the party's right wing. Helen Catt reports.
a surge in support had seemed to make Mr. Cleverley's place on the final ballot a virtual certainty. But Conservative MPs are a notoriously difficult electorate to predict. And today he's made a shock exit from the contest, having apparently lost support. The former business secretary, Kemi Badenoch, topped this round of voting by MPs. Her campaign claims she's been the member's choice throughout. That will now be put to the test as she faces the former immigration minister, Robert Jenrick, in a vote of the membership.
Helen Catt. Next to tennis, and the organisers of Wimbledon have announced there will be no line judges at next year's championships in London. The people who call out or fault are being phased out because the tournament is adopting fully electronic line calling, which is already used by other top-tier international tournaments. But as our tennis correspondent Russell Fuller reports, there might just be a little less drama.
You can't be serious, man. You cannot be serious! That ball was on the line. Chalk flew up.
The linesman called a fault because the ball was on this side of the court.
The chalk came on, it doesn't matter!
No, the very fact that there is a spread of chalk, as you can see, Mr. McEnroe.
A line judge's decision has caused players more even-tempered than John McEnroe much frustration over the years, and most will welcome the greater accuracy and consistency this decision will bring. As one umpire put it, machines do not feel the pressure at five games all in the final set. But many spectators will miss the sight of the officials, dressed in pinstripe shirts and white trousers or a skirt, leaning forward to get the best view of a 130-mile-per-hour serve. Kay Noble has been one of them at 11 championships and had been expecting the decision.
It's bittersweet. It's going to sting for some of us, especially those that have been doing this for many, many years. But personally, I've enjoyed every single day that I got to officiate at Wimbledon. I've got some fantastic memories.
The All England Club's chief executive, Sally Bolton, has thanked the officials for the central role they have played in the championship's history, while acknowledging the sport is heading in a different direction. The men's ATP Tour will be using electronic line calling at all its events from January, and both the Australian Open and the US Open operate without line judges. But some worry where future chair umpires will come from. Many cut their teeth as line judges. Will fewer choose that path, now the carrot of an appearance at Wimbledon has been removed?
Russell Fuller. Elephants, they say, never forget. But new research shows that nature has found ways to ensure an elephant always remembers which way to bend its trunk. Because, it seems, just as humans are left-handed or right-handed, elephants are trunked left or right. Professor Michael Brecht is co-author of the new study and a professor at Humboldt University in Berlin. He told Sean Lay more about the link between this so-called trunkedness and an elephant's wrinkles.
In elephants, everything has to do with the trunk. They're incredibly specialised animals. Elephants are extreme left trunkers, meaning they crest to the left of their body, or right trunkers, meaning they crest to the right of their body. In this particular study, we looked at the wrinkles on the trunk, and it turns out they are very interesting. They are different between two species of elephants that we looked at, Asians and Africans. And they seem to contribute to the trunk's flexibility.
So are there more wrinkles on, say, on the left or the right, or is it where the wrinkles are?
A left trunker would have a bit more wrinkles on the left side. But it turns out it's a small difference, yeah? But it's a very striking difference between left and right trunkers is the whiskers on their trunk. They look very, very different. Yeah, sort of a left trunker, he has almost no whiskers on the right side of the trunk, because in a left trunker, the right side of the trunk is sort of on the floor and gets upraised, yeah? And that's a very striking difference, very different. In a normal mammal, when we look at the face, the whiskers, they kind of look the same in a mouse, in a dog, in a cat, yeah? They look the same left and right. In an elephant, very different, yeah? There's one side in an adult elephant where they're all upraised, and the other side where they're much longer.
Why is there a difference between Asian elephants and African elephants?
It turns out the way the Asian and African elephants crest is also a bit different. African elephants, they have what they call two fingers on the trunk tip. This is two triangular structures, yeah? And with these two fingers, they pinch things, yeah? They're pinchers, yeah? But the Asians are different. They have only sort of at the trunk tip, only one finger. They can also clamp things and pinch something here and there. But what they like to do when you give them a big fruit like a mango or a melon, they wrap objects. Yeah, they sort of wrap the trunk around the object, and that's how they hold it. And we think that's also why their wrinkles are different. Yeah? Turns out the Asians have a lot more wrinkles than the Africans.
Because they're using the whole trunk.
Yeah, because the trunk needs to be more flexible.
Is there any other animal in nature that has something like the elephant's trunk? Or is it really a unique, an unusual organ?
It's a highly unusual organ. It's a highly unusual organ. So basically, when you're a very large animal, you need feeding specializations, because otherwise you cannot come up with enough food. Yeah, like for the baleen whales, this would be the baleen. For the sperm whale, it would be the diving. And for the elephant, it's this trunk. Yeah, it's a very specialized organ.
Professor Michael Brecht from Humboldt University in Germany speaking to Sean Lay. Now back to our main story. As we record this podcast, reports say the outer edge of Hurricane Milton is battering the US state of Florida, with the main body of the storm still hours from landfall. The hurricane is approaching from the Gulf of Mexico and will initially hit Florida's west coast. On the East Coast, our correspondent Sumi Somaskanda has been to Boynton Beach, an hour north of Miami, where many people have fled for safety. I got an update from her.
And we were just there because there are evacuation centers set up in Boynton Beach. You know, it's about three and a half hours from where the storm is expected to make landfall. But Florida has set up evacuation centers really across the peninsula for anyone who is fleeing the storm. And we actually just left Boynton Beach. We could feel the rain and the wind picking up. And just north of us, there was a tornado warning. We wanted to make sure that we were well out of its way. We're now heading back to Miami, which has been really a big staging ground for Florida officials as they are preparing for the storm.
But even where the evacuation centers are, that's still not completely safe, is it?
So there are evacuation centers, as you're mentioning, across where the storm is expected to pass, but they are on things like big warehouses or schools where they can provide some safety to people who are fleeing there. We got a look inside one of the evacuation centers a little bit earlier in the day. They have cots set up, they have Wi-Fi, they have air conditioning, food, water, everything that people need to keep themselves protected. But you're right that many of them are also going to be seeing some of those heavy winds and heavy rain that the hurricane is expected to bring with it.
And those people that have remained in their houses around Tampa, where the hurricane is due to hit first, if they haven't left by now, it's kind of too late.
Well, that is the concern that many Florida officials have at this point, that they have been issuing these warnings now for few days and really through the course of the day today. At this point, the outer bands of the storm are already really hitting southern Florida, southwestern Florida. So it is indeed at this point going to be very tricky for people to leave. Local officials have said if people are hunkering down in their homes and staying there, to listen to local police, to follow the advice there. But it is at this point going to be pretty difficult for people who are still trying to leave and get to higher ground and to safety.
And the people you're talking to, the people who are in the evacuation centres, mm-hmm. how are they feeling? Are they scared? Are they sad? Are they what is the feeling amongst them?
A bit of all of the above. You know, we spoke to a gentleman this morning who had evacuated from the southwestern coast, and he woke up in the middle of the morning when he heard a tornado warning, actually. And that's when he decided, he and his wife, to leave and head to an evacuation center. They have a mobile home there. And he said, quite frankly, you know, that's not worth my life. So we've decided to come here. It's a bit of anxiety, of course. You know, people don't want to leave their home, their belongings behind. But, you know, Floridians are also very used to hurricanes. They have seen so many hurricanes pass through. And again, just 2 weeks ago, Hurricane Helene crossed through Florida, leaving devastation. There's still debris, mounds of debris piled up from Hurricane Helene. So there's an understanding among Floridians that they know that, you know, this is an area in particular that does see hurricanes. But as we've heard from national and state officials, this is expected to be a storm of the century. So again, they are really asking people to heed those warnings and to be as safe as possible.
Sumi Somaskanda in Florida. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Chris Oblakwa. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Rachel Wright. Until next time, goodbye.